thank you for engaging in conversation around these particular prompts. When Farland first pitched the masterclass and said it would be happening over lunch, I said, great, can we talk about food? Because a meal seems like a great place to talk about something like eating, not least since it comes up so often in Luke's gospel. And I was being a little facetious earlier, but not a lot facetious. Jesus really is always eating. Every time you turn around, Jesus is at a meal, and by sheer number of references, Luke's number of references to food is way above Matthew, Mark, and John. So there's clearly something about food that for Luke is really important for understanding the kingdom of God. There's something about food and the way we eat and who we eat with that is really central to understanding what the gospel looks like in the very mundane, everyday realities of our lives. And I'll admit this makes sense to me because potlucks were a very important part of my childhood. We went to a church that was deeply committed to the ministry of potlucks, and you knew, like, you had strategies, right? Like, you would scope out beforehand to find out which side of the long table you wanted to prioritize, right? Because if it's on the other side, you can't always reach it, right? So you knew, like, you always knew you looked out for Jennifer Gray's Little Smokies. Okay, so you're looking for her. You're looking to see whoever has brought poppy seed chicken. It's my personal favorite. All right, King Ranch casserole, also a pretty good hit, right? Lots of things made with Campbell's condensed soup in my childhood at potlucks, for better or worse. That was a pretty consistent feature. Then I got married, and suddenly I found myself at the front of all the potluck lines. Because my husband was like, go, 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 you know. And so I ended up in the front of a lot more lines once I got married. My dad always joked that in the Churches of Christ, we spell fellowship E-A-T, which is a dad joke by every definition of the term. And I rolled my eyes plenty at that as a kid. Now I just think he's right. And I think he's right not just about Churches of Christ. I think he's just right about people. Eating is deeply connected to who we are. It's deeply connected to our community. And I'm going to make the case it's pretty deeply connected to the gospel. So I want to start by thinking about meals in general. Then I want to think about meals in Luke. And we're going to take a little bit of a guided tour of some of the places in Luke where meals show up in sometimes surprising places. Some of these passages will be passages you'll spend a week on in the curriculum. Others of them didn't make it in the 12 weeks, and so we'll talk about them here. And then I want to end with some invitations for us, because we eat every day, multiple times a day, in fact. And if the gospel has something to say about meals, or if meals are a place that we experience the gospel, then thinking about how we eat in terms of the story of Jesus, has the opportunity to intersect with our lives over and over and over and over again. And I think that presents us with some possibilities for thinking in and living through the gospel that we might miss otherwise. And so that's where I'd like for us to end up. So I asked you to think about a meal, a food that is indelibly tied to a particular celebration. And I wonder what came up at your table. Can anybody share one? Okay, turkey at Thanksgiving. We had like turkey deli meat, but we never ate a turkey except Thanksgiving. How was it prepared growing up? Was it roasted? Was it fried?
Baked.
All right, thank you. Somebody else, a food that's really connected to a certain celebration. Yeah.
Black eyed peas on New Year's Day.
Yes. I come from similarly superstitious people. In fact, to this day, my in-laws do not wash clothes on New Year's Day. Is this a superstition any of y'all ran? Like, because you might wash somebody out of the family? Right? Which seems dramatic. But there we are. So in addition to that, so no laundry, but black-eyed peas is New Year's Day. All right, good. Yeah.
My mom made roast beef and rice and gravy and iced tea for lunch every Sunday.
Okay. So Sunday lunch was a particular kind of thing, right? I love that. I saw a hand back here that I missed. Yeah.
Gabby Jones said that it wasn't Christmas Day until she made mac and cheese.
Ooh.
Mac and cheese for
the whole family. Ah, nice. Yeah, for me, it was pumpkin pie. at Thanksgiving, which is incredibly predictable. Not just any pumpkin pie, my mom's recipe of pumpkin pie, which is not a particular, it's not anything special about the recipe. It's just that it's the right one. It's dense, but not too dense. It's got plenty of warm spices, but the nutmeg doesn't overwhelm. I clearly have strong opinions about pumpkin pie. And maybe, like me, you discovered that really that holiday was so connected to that food the first time you celebrated that thing with people other than your family of origin. Because I got married, and I spent my first Thanksgiving with my husband's family, who I love dearly. And like, there was always more food than anybody could ever eat, and really more starches than anyone should ever eat in a single meal. There was one year when I said, I don't think there's any vegetables here. And Tim said, sure there are. There's corn and sweet potatoes. And I was like, honey, those are all starches. So lots of starches and lots of pies. But I approached the dessert table to discover not a single one of them was pumpkin pie. My husband's in-laws, they are cream pie people. Like good homemade, so like coconut cream pie always, chocolate cream pie usually. Occasionally a banana cream pie, but that's their pie game is strong, but it's all pie, it's all cream pies, which I could really take or leave. And I thought, oh, this something is missing from this. So guess what I brought to my second Thanksgiving with my in-laws? I brought pumpkin pie, because Thanksgiving to me is so connected with that particular dish. And what was funny is that after lunch, my brother-in-law, who married my husband's sister, walked up to me with this giant slice and just went, thank you. I don't know why he didn't take it on himself to bring pumpkin pie in the years before I joined the family, but he was with me on the on that particular marker. Food is deeply connected to memory. Of all of our senses, science tells us that smell is really the one most tied to memory. And maybe you've had this experience. My great-grandmother Mamie always wore the same perfume, and she collected things. And so every once in a while, I'll open a tin of like figurines, or she collected Coca-Cola memorabilia, and I'll open a tin, and I'll get hit with a whiff from the tissue paper. Food, of course, involves scent as well as taste. All right, so it's connecting to two senses that are so tied to our memory. I wonder, is there a smell of something, a food, that takes you back?
Fried chicken.
What does it take you back to?
Our childhood.
Yeah.
That my mother always had a cast iron skillet and flour them up and use lard. I got used to that a lot. And,
yeah.
Every Sunday it was fried chicken. The smell was wonderful.
Yes.
Bread baking.
Last weekend I went up to see my mom and Cersei, and we made homemade rolls for the first time in 15 years. Just that smell, because she used to make them all for the big holidays.
Yeah.
And just the smell of that recipe and the homemade rolls, it took me way back.
Food is deeply connected to memory.
The majority of taste is smell.
Yeah.
We can only taste four things, and everything else is smell.
Yeah. So it's so deeply tied to those memory senses, both our senses and our memory. And I'm thinking of the examples you've shared, and I'm thinking, too, how closely food is tied to family. My great-great-grandparents, who I knew as Cordy and Baldy, how's that for a nickname, owned a gas station and diner in Paducah, Texas. And we have some of their family recipes, right? The fact that we have family recipes already tells you something about the way food is connected with our sense of community, right? Sometimes those are secret family recipes. In the case of Cordy and Baldy, it's not so much that they were secret. They just didn't have any information in them, right? And this is true. I wish I had been able to get a scan from my mom. My parents are moving right now, but I would have scanned the recipe card for you. Baldy's chili recipe says, cook meat and spices until done, period. That was the recipe. One of the foods that came up at our table tied to a particular meal was cornbread dressing. And thankfully, my husband and I had avoided that conflict because his family, like my family, are cornbread dressing people, right? So we had circumvented that Thanksgiving conflict. The cornbread dressing recipe we make is from my great-great-grandmother. And the recipe there, after you've crumbled the bread and the cornbread and you've added the sage and the other things, says add broth till it looks right. Right? Again, not all that helpful. These are recipes that are meant to be learned while you have to stand on a kitchen chair to see over the counter, while your great-grandmother holds the spoon, right? These are family recipes, not just in that you got them from a family member, but that you learned them from a family member, right? And I remember standing in the kitchen and my mom showing me, like her great-grandmother had showed her, when it gets to this consistency, slop, this is when it's ready to go in the oven. Right? Food is deeply connected to family. It's also deeply connected to culture. Right? And those of us, we had a couple of examples of meals eaten from different cultures. And maybe at your table, if you thought about a memorable meal because of where you were or a time when you were eating in a place that was really different than you were used to, maybe some of those were in, if you've had the privilege of traveling, in a culture that's not your own. Right? All kinds of things are present at the table, all kinds of cultural expectations. In some ways, the topography and geography of a place is present at the table in the form of what grows there, right? What people eat on a day-to-day basis. Social protocols in the sense of like how things are done here, all of those things are present at the table. And I think we recognize that in the way we kind of teach table manners to our kids. I have a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old. This is an ongoing, we'll say opportunity instead of challenge, an ongoing opportunity at my house. But learning how to set the table was practically the earliest chore I remember learning. My mom had these vinyl placemats that would show you where, like in bright colors, would show you where the various things went. And to this day, I instinctively set the table in the same way, right? Which way the knife turns, where the glass goes. Now, I will admit to you, I have a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old, so the times I formally set the table are fairly limited. But when I do, I still do it that way. I'm curious, what were important table manners when you were growing up? What were the rules that governed how people were together at the table?
No TV.
No TV.
No singing.
No, okay. Is that a rule for you too? Okay, you were the first two people I have ever met that had that same rule. That was our big rule. Okay, oh, I'm so delighted. I thought it was just my parents trying to get a break from like Disney lyrics. Or Singing in the Rain, or other old musicals that were such a part. My sister and I sang all the time. So yeah, no singing at the table.
And no reading.
No reading, right? So no no external media of any kind, right? You're here.
No leaving the table until everybody's done.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That was a
no-no. Mm-hmm. You got to wait till everybody's finished.
Don't break the furniture.
Uh-huh. I have said we don't move the furniture at dinner because the 2-year-old has figured out that if he just shoves really hard, he can move the table across our hardwood at our dining room. Yeah, don't break the furniture. It's a good baseline, really. Good. What else? What were other kind of table manners?
No elbows on the table.
Yeah, no elbows on the table. I remember that one more from camp than from home. My mom was less of a stickler. Put your elbows on the table at camp and they're going to make you do something silly. I once had to sing I'm a Little Teapot while standing on my chair because I'd been caught with my elbows on the table at camp. Any other table, like etiquette kinds of things? Rules that governed?
Chew with your mouth closed.
Yes. I mentioned again the age of my children. This is also a growth area for us. Meals are so significant. They're tied to our expectations for how we relate to one another. They're tied to our culture. They're tied to our memory. And they're tied to our relationships with other people. And one of the times this was driven home most to me was the time I left a library dedication with a pocket full of chicken liver. I was in Tanzania, East Africa, with my church. We financially supported a mission there. And growing up, my mom had spent a number of years as the librarian at my private Christian school in Grand Prairie. I grew up in Arlington. And so we, while we were there, they wanted to set up a library in their children's school, and I sort of volunteered, and some of my friends helped me, and we put together this library. Thank us, they hosted us a kind of surprise lunch, or a surprise reception. So it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we've already eaten lunch, and we arrive at this event, not really knowing what it was, and there is a full meal prepared. Now, we are not in the least hungry, and we were not sufficiently trained for cross-cultural interaction, but we knew enough to know that you don't refuse this food, right? And we're not serving our own plates, so we are being given these really generous helpings of rice and beans and chicken, which means that we were eating more meat right then than the people serving us would have seen over a month, right? The chickens we occasionally ate there, were incredibly small, not very much meat on the bone, nothing like the kind of alarmingly sized chicken breasts you buy at the grocery store here. These were tiny. This was incredibly expensive, right? And there's all of this chicken. And so our plates are loaded, we're seating kind of at a front table, and people are offering sort of thanks and dedication to the school. And I had my bottle of Fanta, which was the drink of choice, and I took a bite of something that had neither the taste nor the texture that I was expecting. And I looked down, and I realized that was what was not like a chicken leg or like a chicken nugget. That was an organ. Suburban girls in North Texas don't encounter a lot of chicken organs. This was a first for me. And so I had first the moment of kind of like a visceral, oh no, you know, followed by the social, oh no, right? I was determined I was not going to leave any food on my plate. I didn't know enough, but I knew that how I responded to this meal was going to say something very important about my relationship to my hosts. And so I'm like problem solving on the go in between sips of Fanta. And I ultimately, in the end, they came by to clear our plates, and I dropped my napkin on my plate, and then I took my napkin with me when they took the plate, and I put it in my pocket. And somewhere between the building where we were and the house where we were staying, I disposed of the chicken liver somewhere in a bush for some lucky creature. Not an ideal solution. Someone would have enjoyed the chicken liver, but it was the best I could figure out to do at the time. Right? Because I knew that the way I behaved at this table was going to say something. All right. So let's think about meals in Jesus' day. Because there is a lot that is different about meals in Jesus' day. And if we've got a sense of that, then it's going to make the teaching scenes at meals and the encounters at meals resonate more fully for us. This is a quote from an anthropologist from a PhD dissertation about meals in ancient Rome that said, "You are what, how, when, and where you eat." And I think that's true of us, and I think it's true in Luke's day too. So let's pretend that we are going to dinner in the first century. All right, and let's start with what's on the table. First of all, there's no meat. Right? Not unless you're very, very wealthy for a variety of reasons, one of which is the lack of refrigeration. Right? In the Corinthian correspondence, one of the reasons meat sacrificed to idols is a live question for this church. That's one of the few ways you get fresh meat. It's available after an animal has been sacrificed. Because short of preserved meats, there's no other way to get fresh meat. Right? So there's almost no meat on the table. Maybe some fish. But also maybe not. So we're thinking about the scene from the sermon this morning with Peter in Luke chapter 5, where they bring in this kind of miraculous catch of fish, which makes Peter's decision to leave everything and follow Jesus stand out even more, right? He's never going to have a haul like this again. And he walks away. But fishing was a highly regulated and controlled industry. You owed a lot of people above you a lot of things. And so even Peter's big catch would probably not have landed on Peter's table. A lot of it's going to go to pay to the taxes that you owe to Herod, who had a palace right there on the lake. So there's no meat on the table. There are forms of bread, right? We have some vegetables. Often bread was, because the bread was hard, was often soaked in a kind of fish sauce, which, based on what we can tell about the recipe, is not unlike fish sauce today in Thai cuisine. Very pungent, kind of a fermented kind of sauce, because again, no refrigeration. We have some kind of pungent sauce, some hard bread. It's also only the second time we've eaten today. We're generally only two meals. There's no between meal grazing, right? Nobody walks by the refrigerator and just stands there trying to figure out what they're going to eat. Like, I'm hungry for something, but I don't know what. This is not a problem they had in the first century. Right? It's only our second meal that day. There is water to drink. By a sort of trial and error, lots of people had figured out you boil it first, right? Or there is wine, which is generally three parts water and one part wine. So very, very diluted. It's also very cheap, all right? So vinegary, right? If you are someone in a place like Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, this is more or less what's on the table. Obviously, the more resources you have, the more variety you will have at your meals, the more likely you are to have meat and so forth. But for most common, ordinary folks, this is sort of where we're at. It's also helpful for, I think, for us to remember what kind of socioeconomic status looked like. Can I get two people to stand up for me? I'm not going to ask you to do anything embarrassing. No, My Little Teapot. I just need two people to stand. Okay, I've got one and two. Congratulations, you are wealthy. If you could sit down now. If we were a microcosm of first century culture, all right, so the first century ancient Mediterranean. So we're going to include Rome and Greece, Asia Minor, Turkey, and the land of Israel, and northern Egypt. So that kind of rim. In terms of socioeconomic distribution, you two in the room would be the only people who were wealthy. Right? Maybe one of you might be similar to what we call like middle class. But middle class doesn't really exist in the first century world. Can I get 14 of you to stand up? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I need three more. 12, 13, and 14. Okay, you are not just poor. Everybody's poor. You are below subsistence level poverty poor. You are not, you can sit down now. You're not sure, not only are you basically making enough to meet your needs, right? That's true of almost everybody. You're not sure you can meet your needs. Right, you are often not sure where your next meal is coming from. It's helpful to know, I think, because every time I remember the feeding of the 5,000 being taught as a child, it was always about sharing, right? Because it's like one of the few Bible stories, at least in John's version, that features a kid. But I think in this context, it might be good to think about the fact that people were hungry, right? Think about the dynamics of the social context. You've got 5,000 people there. These are people to not only have enough, but to have 12 baskets left over. These are people who didn't have leftovers. Makes me frankly embarrassed about how many leftovers I throw away. Right? When we think about the context for food, it helps us to see the significance of what's communicated at meals and the significance of miracles like the feeding of the 5,000. All right, who ate with whom? In general, you ate with people who were like you, who were of your own social class and social standing. This is true in part because ancient views of friendship were all about friendship between equals. And part of that was that there is an expectation of reciprocity, right? If you invite me over for dinner, I am now socially obligated in a very strong way. Like if I don't meet it, I'm subject to shame. I'm now socially obligated to invite you back. And if you feed me steak, I cannot make you tacos, right? I've got to come up to the level of what you provided. And so table fellowship tended to happen between people of the same social class or the same kind of social group for that reason. Eating together at the table was a mark of fellowship or even kind of like kinship, right? Like we're family now that we've eaten together. And so being together at the same table is an important part of establishing social bonds, right? So this is why it's such a thing when Jesus keeps eating with sinners, right? It's not just proximity. It's that eating together communicates something about a relationship going forward, right? And that tends to not be part of the way we think about meals in our own context. They don't carry that kind of weight. If you're Jewish, there's different elements to meals, right? There are clean and unclean foods, and that's really difficult to navigate in a context in which you are not in control of your own destiny, right? Israel's an occupied country, and many Israelites are navigating life in the diaspora, right? There's Jewish communities in Rome, or Jewish communities in Philippi, or Jewish communities in Ephesus, who are trying to figure out how to maintain, how to keep kosher in a context that's not set up for that. And the Jewish people were widely looked down on for, like, eating weird, right? For having weird rules about what you do at the table. That and the practice of Sabbath were two, when you find anti-Semitic sentiment in the Roman world, which you did, Sabbath and the accusation of laziness that accompanied it, and things about food were two of the things most often represented, right? And so that meant that Jewish people tended to eat with other Jewish people. Right? So if we're going to dinner in the first century, there's a lot that's different. But there's also a lot that's the same, right? Then, as well as now, food communicates something. What, with whom, and where you eat is still deeply connected to culture and to memory and to meaning. And so with all of that in mind, I want to look through, we're going to take our kind of guided tour of some key scenes, and I'll engage in some conversation along the way. But I want to start with the first one. This is in Luke chapter 5, because the very first time in Luke's gospel the disciples are identified as a group, it's at a meal, and that seems important. All right, so table fellowship, we've covered this already. So this is Levi, Luke chapter 5. Levi gave a great banquet. All right, let's pause and remember who Levi was.
Tax collector.
And Levi, we note, has responded to Jesus exactly the same way Peter has. Right. Jesus says, follow me. Peter leaves everything to follow. Jesus says, follow me. Levi leaves everything to follow. He walks away. And then he hosts a banquet. And we are told there was a large crowd of tax collectors and others reclining at the table with them. All right, that seems like a detail worth mentioning because none of us are laying down right now. In the first century, you recline at a meal, and that usually you lay sort of leaning on one arm on a cushion. Tables were low, and your feet would be pointing away from the table, right? That was the posture you assumed at a table in the first century. And this detail makes some sense of things that otherwise seem a little weird. There's a story in Luke 7 where a local woman, anoints Jesus' feet at a meal, and it says that she stood behind him and wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. And the logistics of that are kind of hard to understand. And I think as a kid, I imagined that she like army crawled under the table to get to Jesus' feet. But feet are gross, and feet are pointed away from the table toward the back. All right, so Jesus is partaking in a meal like anybody partook in a meal, and he is reclining at the table. The Pharisees and their scribes were complaining to his disciples. This first mention of them as a group. Eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? It's an interesting thing. There's lots of interesting things happening here. One of them, and you've probably heard this, but you know that most of the yous in the New Testament are y'alls. Right? If you're ever reading Paul, there's like two times in Paul that the you is a singular you. Every other time, you just need to go full Texan and say y'all. In fact, my Greek professor used to have us translate it as y'all. So that she could tell that we knew it was plural and not singular. This is a y'all. Why do y'all eat with tax collectors and sinners? They're not critiquing Jesus. They're critiquing the disciples. The very first scene in which the disciples show up as a group, they're catching flack for how they eat and who they eat with. Now, Jesus is, of course, central to why this is happening, but still, the disciples are not observing Jesus eat with tax collectors and sinners. The disciples are eating with tax collectors and sinners. Right? Jesus is the one who answered them. Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I've come not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Right? So Jesus makes some early claims about what he's here to do and who he is particularly here for. And this language actually echoes a little bit what he said in Nazareth not that long ago, right? Where Jesus' interest, his priority, is on the oppressed, right? On those who are sick, on those who are on the outside of things, right? Jesus is here not for the well, but for the sick. All right? The scene continues to unfold. We've got new questions about food. And they, this is the Pharisees and the scribes, said to him, John's disciples, like the disciples of the Pharisees, frequently fast and pray, but your disciples eat and drink. A couple interesting things there, including Jesus is not the only one who has disciples. Right? To be a disciple, by the way, simply means to be a learner. You could be a disciple of a musician in learning to play that particular piece. You could be a disciple of a craftsman. To be a disciple simply means it's just the word for learner, right? It has, by the time of Jesus, it started out, it was really just the word for learner. By the time of Jesus, it has the sense of being like an adherent or a follower. And so you would have people affiliated with a particular teacher, and that seems to be what's happening. You've got the Pharisees have disciples, so does John the Baptist. And there's a distinction drawn, again, based on this, the fact that they eat and drink, and they're not fasting, right? So second question out of the gate, also about eating. And here Jesus' answer seems to be about judging the appropriate time for the appropriate kind of thing. Right? Jesus isn't down on fasting. In fact, he says a day is coming when that's the appropriate response. But it's not today. Right? The friends of the bridegroom know the bridegroom is with them. All right, I didn't include this, but the very next scene is the disciples eating heads of grain on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees critique that they're working by picking the grain, right? So like the first three stories about the disciples all have something to do with food, right? And how food interacts with what they sense is going on in God's work in the world. How food interacts with how they think they're supposed to relate to other people. Jesus is famous for eating with tax collectors and sinners. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all include this scene. They all talk about it. Luke just talks about it more. And it shows up in this, the aspect of Jesus' life shows up in some unexpected places. So by show of hands, how many of us have heard the parable of the lost sheep or the lost coin or the lost son? Okay, so this is all of us, right? The setup for those three parables is that they were grumbling because Jesus ate with tax collectors and sinners. So this feature of Jesus' ministry just keeps coming up over and over again. Less famously, but equally importantly, Jesus didn't just eat with tax collectors and sinners. He also ate with Pharisees and teachers of the law. Jesus shows up at a lot of people's tables over the course of the story. Going backward instead of forward. There we go. All right, let's look at another couple of examples. I love this particular piece. The previous one was also a Japanese artist. For Jesus around the table, you can see the broken bread. There at the top. Here's another Japanese artist in a more traditional style. There's this scene in Luke chapter 13, and this is a period of Jesus' ministry where things are getting more tense. Right? The tension has really been ramping up since chapter 11. It's chapter 11 where Jesus is accused of doing the miracles he's doing by the power of Beelzebub. Right? That's a pretty weighty kind of accusation. And it's this section of the story where we really feel the kind of opposition to Jesus begin to grow. There's a scene in Luke 13 where we're told Jesus went from one town and village after another, teaching as he made his way to Jerusalem. And someone asked him, "Lord, will only a few be saved?" He said to them, "Strive to enter through the narrow door. For I tell you, many will try to enter and will not be able. When once the owner of the house has got up and shut the door, and you begin to stand outside and to knock on the door, saying, 'Lord, open to us,' he will say to you, 'I do not know where you come from.' Then you will begin to say, 'But we ate and drank with you, and you taught in our streets.' But he will say, 'I know where you come from. Go away from me, all you evildoers.'" So there's an interest. We see a similar statement in the Sermon on the Mount, right? Where in the part of the end of the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says like three different ways, you have to actually do this stuff, right? You can't just say it. And there's a similar sense there. It's not just enough to have eaten and drunk with Jesus. You have to be people who do the things. What he goes on to say is there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth when you see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, and you yourselves have thrown out. And in the midst of that scene of real judgment, right, Jesus' own rhetoric is kind of ramping up as opposition to him increases. He says this, "Then people will come from east and west, from north and south, and will eat in the kingdom of God. Indeed, some are last who will be first, and some are first who will be last." We get one of those great reversal kind of statements in this scene. But the scene painted for us is everyone joining Abraham at the table, right? It's a banquet scene. Everyone will come together and eat in the kingdom of God. And you've got this geographical reference, right? The north, south, east, and west. Everyone come together in the context of a meal. And that's interesting to put in conversation with communion and the words of institution, right? Because what does Jesus say there? "I won't drink this again until I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom." Right? So the sense that even life with God once Jesus returned is a banquet. Right? Or is it one of the children's songs I used to sing when I was a child, and I don't think I've sung since. He invites us into his banquet table. His banner over us is love. Right? That's where we have this reference. And this one is interesting both because the claim of table fellowship is insufficient. Right? It's not enough to be in proximity to Jesus. You actually have to be like him. But also because of this image of life with God as a banquet. All right, Luke 14. I'm going to spend some more time here. But before you do that, I simply want you to pay attention to this image as best you can see it. It's called Eucharist with the Poor. It's from this one also from a Catholic artist in the United States. What do you notice about this image? Right, so we're imagining no one's reclining at this table. Everyone is seated upright.
Not much food.
Right, there's very little.
They look pretty motley. They're not finely dressed by any means.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Someone said they look sad. What communicates sadness to you? What do you see? Yeah, there's things happening with posture, right? Hunched over.
You don't see them talking to each other either.
Yeah.
Have there been any women in any of these pictures? Or are they in the kitchen cooking and serving?
Yeah, it's a great question. The first one did. There were women in that picture. If you're imagining reimagining in this case the Last Supper, then there are not there. It's the 12, and there are not any women. Although Luke is famous for including the presence of women more than anybody else, right? And so, Luke might ask the same question, is what I'm saying. Where are the women? Because I know they were there. Anything else you notice about this image? Yeah, so in this reimagining of what Jesus' table fellowship looks like, these are folks who look like they've been around the block a few times.
On the face we don't see is the face of Jesus.
Yeah, that's interesting as an artistic choice, that he's given away by the halo, but we don't see his face. In Luke 14, Jesus is in one of those scenes I mentioned where he's in the home of a Pharisee, right? He's been invited there for lunch. It's the Sabbath day, right? If you know anything about Jesus and the Sabbath, what do you think has probably happened on this day?
He's been ridiculed for,
there's been some kind of conflict,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If, I sometimes joke with my students, if there's ever an exam question that says, what day is it when this happens? It's always Sabbath, because for some reason it's never Tuesday. So if the day is mentioned, it's always because it's Sabbath. And over again, Jesus has been in some kind of conflict. And it's true, while Jesus is on the way to this meal at the Pharisee's house, he just happens to come across a man with dropsy. The condition is a condition of swelling. And Jesus heals him, and then they critique him. And there's just enough about that scene that makes you wonder if it's just a little too convenient. Like they just happened with these Pharisees to run across this sick man. It feels there's something about it that you almost wonder if it's kind of a setup. Because they know what Jesus is going to do. This is not a surprise. He did it in the last chapter. Right? This is who Jesus is. Jesus ends up in the home of a Pharisee. And then Jesus does something a little bold. So he's in the context of a meal, and he starts critiquing other people's table manners. So first of all, this is an aspect of dinner we didn't talk about. Where you sat was indicative of your social standing. And we know that in some contexts, right? If you're at a wedding that has a formal dinner, the wedding party is seated up front, usually the bride and the groom are in the middle. If you're at a corporate dinner, officers of the company will be up at a front table. If you are at a cultural event, right, who gets to sit near the speaker? Well, it's donors or people who've contributed or people who know the speaker or the artist or something. So there are settings where we recognize that. But by and large, if you walk into Chili's, you're not thinking about, all right, we got to make sure the most important person sits here, right? That's not a calculation we're doing on a day-to-day basis. That's a kind of a special occasion thing. But in the first century world where you sat actually really did matter. And so there are places of prominence at the table. Tables were often shaped like U's. And the place of prominence would be the center seat here, kind of at the bottom of the U. In larger households, you would have multiple tables in different rooms. All right, so the head table, they're eating steak. The next table down might have the aforementioned tacos. The table back there has got beans and cornbread. All right, so what was even available at your table was dependent on your social standing. And so Jesus is at this meal, and he's the invited guest. He's probably in the place of honor, and he's watching people try to, like, shuffle over and switch the name cards, right? They're finagling for a seat of higher honor than one they might have been assigned. And Jesus offers what's both a kingdom parable and also some pretty good advice, which is whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself to be exalted, right? Don't be the kind of person who's seeking out higher honor. And then he says this. Jesus says to his host, when you give a luncheon or dinner, you know, like this one, do not invite your friends and your neighbors in case they might invite you in return and you would be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you will be repaid because they cannot repay you. You'll be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. I don't know about you, but you have to think this gets a little awkward for a minute. Right? He's accepted the invitation, and he's going to offer a word of critique to his host in the context of a meal. And think about what we said earlier about how meals worked in social settings. Jesus has just basically dismantled that whole system. You do not invite people who will pay you back. Right? And don't do it because you intend not to be repaid. There's this moment, and I'm reading into this a little bit, but there's right after this, someone who's at the table says, well, blessed are those who eat in the kingdom of God. And you have to think it's someone who just can't take social awkwardness and is like trying to figure out a way to restore some like equilibrium. It's like, oh, let's move on to a new. And in response to that, Jesus tells a parable that illustrates this exact point and ends with the same list. Invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. Invite those who are on the outside of things. All right? Construct at your tables a different way of relating to other people than is the default of the people around you. All right. Surely the most famous meal is the Last Supper. And Luke tells it just like Matthew and Mark do and John does in a roundabout way in John 6. But one of the things that happens in Luke's version is you have a familiar dispute about who is the greatest. Luke sets it at the Last Supper. And so a dispute arose among them as to which one of them was considered greatest. It's like adventures and missing the point. Jesus said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them and call themselves, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. Now, that's interesting language. It's not that they're called benefactors, it's that they call themselves benefactors, which is a different thing, I think. But you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, which is to say, the one with least status. This is a society in which age is honored above almost anything else. And so to be young was to be unimportant. When Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven belonging to children, he's not talking about it belonging to the precocious or the curious or the sweet. He's talking about it belonging to people who don't count for much. The greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater? The one who serves at the table, the one who sits at the table, or the one who serves? Is it not the one who sits at the table? I am among you as one who serves. And the word he uses there, which is related to the word we just translate as ministry, was specifically designated for ministry at the table. Right, it's the word used to describe Martha's service in chapter 10. Right? Jesus imagines himself in the role of a table servant. He's the one bringing the food. And he's inviting them to reframe, again, their sense of who counts and who doesn't count. And he's putting that in terms of table fellowship. Right, this is a woodcut from a German author. Here it's Jesus' face you see, and everyone else's faces you don't. But I found myself drawn to the sense of contrast here. They think something is happening, and Jesus wants to say, actually, it's the opposite. The meal in Emmaus is probably the best known. In terms of the, aside from the Last Supper, this is from the same artist as the beginning image. Cerezo Barada is he's a Spanish artist in South America, and he's done the same thing here that he did in the previous one, right? And he's pictured Jesus among the ordinary laborers and common folks in Latin America. So we notice we have a man and a woman here, which might have struck you as unusual. Who is with Jesus while he's walking on the road? What are we told? We're told two disciples. One of them is named Cleopas. That's a man's name. The other one is never named. And so some across history have wondered if it's maybe Cleopas and his wife. Right? People have wondered the same thing about when Jesus sends out the 72 in pairs. We know there are women who are traveling with Jesus. We know their names. And some have wondered if maybe some of them are married couples. It's speculation. We don't know. He's clearly chosen one option. We know Cleopas is male. We might assume the other one is, but we're not told. Jesus is with them, and they can't recognize him. Right? There's this great moment where, you know, Jesus joins them on the road, and they're walking along, and their faces are cast down, and Jesus says, "What's going on?" And they said, "Are you the only person in Jerusalem? Are you living under a rock?" Right? What they say is, "Are you the only person in Jerusalem who does not know what has just happened?" And Jesus is like, "Tell me more." And so they said there was this Jesus of Nazareth, who was a powerful prophet. And then they said, "We had thought that he was going to be the one to redeem Israel." It's all past tense for them. "We had thought he was going to be the one to redeem Israel." And then Jesus says, "How foolish you are, and how slow of heart not to believe all that the prophets have said." And then Jesus goes back to every part of Scripture, the law and the prophets and the writings, and he begins to explain to them the things about himself, and especially the things about Jesus that for his earliest followers needed the most explaining. Why God's Messiah would suffer and why God's Messiah would die. Those two things did not compute with any of the various ways of imagining the role of the Messiah. And that's what Jesus explains. And so famously, when is it that they finally see Jesus? In the moment when he breaks the bread. There's an interesting thing happening here because Jesus, at this meal, takes bread, he blesses it, he breaks it so that they can partake in it. Sequence of verbs sound familiar to anybody? Right? Where do we know that from? We know it from the Last Supper, right? There's this echo back to Eucharist, which is interesting. Luke uses it two other places. He uses the same sequence of verbs to describe the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus takes bread, blesses it, breaks it, and then distributes it. The other place it shows up, and this is bonus content because this is not in Luke, but it's in Acts chapter 27 during Paul's shipwreck scene. Paul is on a ship that has been tossing and turning for 14 days. He's trying to convince people to eat because God's going to save them. And in their midst, Paul takes bread, blesses it, breaks it, and partakes in it. That's an odd place to echo the Eucharist. And if you'd like to know more, I can bore you at length because I wrote a dissertation chapter about Acts 27. I can give you more detail than you ever wanted to know. But there's something about that sequence and moments when God's work is apparent. Right? And not for nothing has Emmaus captured the imagination of generations of Christians. What does it mean to know Jesus in the breaking of bread? To recognize Jesus in a moment of table fellowship? Because what's the reason they're eating with him? It's because they invited him in. There's this moment I think we miss in the story that's more significant than we give it credit for. And that's that they get to Emmaus and Jesus keeps walking. He's going to go on. What happens if they don't invite Jesus to stay? Which would have been the expectation if you encountered a stranger, that you invited them to stay with you. They do. They practice the kind of hospitality Jesus taught them. And in doing so, they meet the risen Lord. Jesus was known to them in the breaking of the bread. I'd like to pose some challenges. I'd like you to choose one to take up. One option is to do what I'm going to call a meal audit. For a week, pay attention to where you eat. Maybe make a list. Who am I eating with? What am I eating? Where am I eating? And then when you get to the end of the week, you could start tomorrow and come back to it next Sunday. Look back over it and ask yourself some questions. Maybe there are some things about that are unavoidable. But maybe there are some openings in there for the gospel to have a little bit more to say about your meals. To do a meal audit. That's invitation number one. Invitation number two is to find a way to share a meal with someone whose life experience could hardly be more different than yours. In Abilene, I often point students to Bob's. It's Breakfast on Beach Street. Some of you with Abilene connections may know about this. It's a ministry of downtown churches in Abilene that feed breakfast to the homeless population. And I have part of my students in my Luke class is part of a project for them to go and volunteer and eat breakfast downtown after serving it. They give sack lunches out afterward. Maybe there's an opportunity like that, but there are lots of ways to do this. You might even consider eating a meal with people of a different political party. That might be a way of doing it. If we really want to feel like Jesus is pushing us, that might do it. Find a way to eat a meal with someone whose life experiences could hardly be more different than yours. It's another challenge I'll invite you to take up. Another one is to attend to your meals in a different kind of way. When you are at a meal with others, are there places that you have an opportunity to express gratitude for the way God's good news is present to you in that meal? Could you express gratitude for the people who grew the food you were eating? There are very few things in our life that connect us more to the dirt than the fact that we eat multiple times a day. Is there an opportunity to express gratitude for that? Is there an opportunity to see in your dining companions the kingdom of God at work among you? Is the opportunity to see in the people around the table with you ways God has provided for you? Is there an opportunity in your meal to thank God for the goodness that is food that tastes good? God filled the world with flavor. Surely that's meant, can you imagine a calculation in which flavor is sort of superfluous? All you really need is fuel. But no, God created a world full of flavor and spice and variety. Is there a way in your partaking of food from a culture that's not your own to recognize God's kingdom that cuts across every culture? Or imagine a meal in which people come from the East and the West. The gospel at the table is one of the places where I think we can grapple with the way the gospel is meant to infuse every moment, every interaction, every opportunity. And so I would invite you to take up one or all of those and to see if we can cultivate a kind of theological awareness of what's happening and what's possible when we do a very human, very ordinary thing and we feed ourselves and others. Because I think if we take Jesus at his practice and at his word, there is something of the gospel in knives and forks and plates. So thank you for thinking about that with me this afternoon.